A deafening explosion rocked the vehicle, tossing it into the air. Peyton felt herself float for a second. The sensation was sickening, like the moment at the summit of a roller coaster before it begins its rapid descent. The SUV crashed to the ground on the driver's side, throwing Peyton and Hannah's intertwined bodies into the ceiling and then depositing them in a crumpled mass against the side wall. When the sound of twisting metal and breaking glass stopped, Peyton heard Hannah screaming at the top of her lungs. Up front, Jonas unsnapped his seatbelt and reached for the passenger side glove box, which was now above him. He popped it open, took out a handgun, and pulled the slide back, chambering around.
"No! Jonas!" Peyton cried out. But it was too late.
He stood, his feet on the driver's side door, his head and shoulders poking out through the passenger side window, which was now on the top of the SUV. He began firing, but only got three rounds out before automatic gunfire erupted, ripping into him, his red blood spattering the seats. He fell, and the gun dropped from his hand into the back seat within Peyton's reach. Hannah cried and shook, the pain clearly overwhelming her. Peyton wrapped her arms around her while she eyed the gun. A second later, the SUV's back gate swung open. Hands reached inside and dragged the two women out. Chapter 34. Desmond stared at his legs. For the first time since he had woken up in that hotel room in Berlin, he knew how he had gotten the scars. The memory had left him wanting to know more. At the moment, however, he had a more pressing issue, escaping his makeshift cell. He lay on his back and listened for a few minutes, hoping for any clues about where he was or who might be around. But the barn was completely quiet, the other stalls apparently empty. He looked around for something he could use as a weapon. His best option was to pry one of the rebar rods free. He moved around the cell, studying the bases of the rods, searching for a weak link. He settled on a rod on the left wall, then swept his hands across the floor, searching for anything he could use to dig with. He found a rock that was almost 2 inches long, and went to work scraping the dirt aside. When he'd moved enough dirt to allow the rebar to be wiggled, he planted his feet, grabbed the rebar with both hands, and pulled. His aching body sent waves of pain through him. He rhythmically pushed out and returned, hoping the change in pressure would crack the weld. 10 minutes later, his head was drenched in sweat, his body spent, and the weld was just as solid as it had been when he'd started. He sat down against the wall, panting. He picked up the rock and turned it in his fingers. Without thinking, he turned to the dark wood and scratched the words, "Desmond Hughes was here." He sat back on the dirt floor, studying his own name carved in jagged white letters on the wall. He leaned forward and added a second line, "I'm innocent." He had written the line without even really considering it. He wondered if it was true. In his memories, he had seen himself in a warehouse where people were being treated in makeshift hospital cells. But treated for what? He knew there was an outbreak in Africa, possibly of Ebola, and that Peyton Shaw was there. Peyton, the woman he, or someone else, had instructed him to warn. Had he known this outbreak was coming? Someone did. In another memory, he had seen a man with a badly scarred face standing before a group, telling him the world would soon change. Desmond lay on his back in the cell, his mind wandering. Wherever he was, it was hot and arid, easily 75 degrees in the dead of night. He was in the tropics, in a very dry region, Africa. Or maybe an island in the Caribbean. No, an island was unlikely. He didn't smell the salt of the sea. In fact, there was no breeze at all blowing through the open central lane of the barn. He began assembling an escape plan. He knew his adversaries were pros. They had taken him alive for a reason. That meant they wanted to keep him alive. The sweat covering his face might work in his favor. He spat on the jagged rock and wiped it on his pants, attempting to clean it. Then he lifted his shirt and scratched the rock against his side, just enough to break the skin and bring blood to the surface. He spread the blood around, then held his shirt to the wound, letting the dark red soak through. The sound of boots marching down the corridor focused him. He lay on his bad side and slowed his breathing, trying to look more vulnerable. His best chance was to lure the visitor into his cell,
If he couldn't do that, he'd have to attack the men through the bars and hope he could reach for the key. Perhaps he could throw the rock. With his hands bound together, it would be difficult to throw very hard. But if he could make the man stumble closer to the bars, Desmond might be able to reach through and get his hands on him. The soldiers stopped square in front of his stall. He wore full body armor, including a black helmet with a visor.
"I need a doctor," Desmond said, his voice weak. "Somebody ripped my side open, dragging me in here."
The sweat on his face supported the lie, but the soldier made no movement or response.
"You hear me? I need a doctor."
The man's voice was gruff, hard.
"This look like a hospital to you?"
"No.
Apparently it's a home for idiot mercenaries. Incidentally, what do you think your employer will do to you when I die of sepsis shortly after delivery?"
Desmond paused.
"Gotta think your life expectancy plummets."
"Show me."
Some of the bravado was gone from the man's voice.
"Doctor! You're lying!"
Desmond turned and moved his right arm slightly, revealing part of his blood-soaked side. He made his words come out even more labored.
"I figure they'll kill me anyway. Least I'll take you with me.
Walk to me."
"Screw you,"
Desmond spat. For a moment he thought the man was going to open the cell. Instead, he turned on his heel and walked out. He returned 10 minutes later, carrying a full tray of food and a small case. Hope filled Desmond until the man slid the tray through the bars. It was flimsy, styrofoam, useless.
"Eat,"
the suited man said.
"Not hungry. Too busy dying."
Desmond was incredibly hungry, but he knew what was in the food. He'd be unconscious shortly after his first bite. Then they would inspect his wound, discover his deception, and regard everything he said afterward with complete disbelief, ruining his chances of escape.
"You really want to do this the hard way?"
"I thought we already were."
The soldier set the case on the ground, opened it, and prepped something. Desmond rose, ready to throw the rock and charge the iron bars. But the soldier was quick. He drew a pistol from the case and fired once, striking Desmond in the chest. Chapter 35. Millen came to with a start. His torso ached, but it was the sensation at his leg that caught his attention, something slithering around his left calf. He lay still, waiting to see if whatever it was would move on. Instead, it closed tightly, squeezing like a vise. He thought it was no larger than an inch around, but it was strong, and with each passing second, it cut off more of his circulation. He had fallen down a vertical shaft. He wasn't sure how far. He was surrounded by absolute darkness, except for a single point of light in the distance, like a pen light in a train tunnel. The thing closed more tightly around his leg. To Millen's surprise, it pulled with incredible force, dragging him across the rock into the wall. The light shone brighter, raked across his body. He saw what had ensnared him, a rope tied in a loop, lassoed around his leg.
"Stop!"
he yelled. The rope continued pulling at him, lifting him into the air. The pressure on his left ankle where the rope had settled was excruciating. His shoulders were still on the ground, but with each passing second he rose. They couldn't hear him. He still had his suit on, and it was muffling his voice. He had no choice. He knew it might end his life, but he tore his helmet off and shouted as loud as he could, "Stop!" The reaction, unfortunately, was instantaneous. He fell immediately back to the jagged rock floor. A shock of pain swept through his body. He rolled over, but it made the hurt even worse. He lay still, wishing it would end. For a moment, he thought he would throw up. The nausea passed, and slowly the voice calling down from above came into focus.
"Dr. Thomas, are you all right?"
"Not really,"
he mumbled.
"What?"
It was Quito, his local guide and interpreter.
"Just give me a minute,"
Millen yelled. By degrees, he sat up and took stock. The fall had banged him up pretty badly. He had what felt like a bruised rib, and he doubted there was a single part of his body that wasn't either skinned up or bruised. On the whole, however, he was okay. He would live. He could hike out. He counted himself very, very lucky. The bulky suit had provided some padding.
but the shaft he'd fallen into was at least 20 feet deep, and the bruised rib would make it difficult for him to climb. Thankfully, Keto had called the camp for backup. He had 4 men with him, and together they were able to pull Millen up, though the process was far from pain-free. As soon as he caught his breath, Millen thanked the men at length. They'd brought food and water into the cave, and Millen was glad. He hadn't realized how hungry he was until he took the first bite. When the MRE was half gone, an idea came to him. He placed his helmet back on and stood.
"Can you hike out?" Keto asked. "I won't set any land speed records, but I can manage," Millen said. "But first, I'm going to finish what I came here for."
20 minutes later, Millen watched the bat land near the open MRE and begin nibbling at it. He took aim, pulled the trigger, and tranquilized the animal. It jerked for a moment or two, then fell limp. Millen scooped it up and placed it in the sack.
"Now we can go."
When the 6 men reached the green chem light, they made radio contact with 2 more Kenyan soldiers waiting by the SUVs at the entrance to the cave. Keto informed Millen that the 2 soldiers that had originally driven them here had gone missing, along with the SUV.
"Probably deserted," Keto said. "They have families too. They're no doubt worried about the virus reaching them."
The men at the SUVs relayed more troubling news. As soon as they had arrived at the caves, they'd attempted to check in with the camp at the village, but no one had responded. Millen's mind instantly went to Hannah, and the memory of her sleeping peacefully on the cot that morning. Despite the pain in his ribs and legs, he picked up his pace. The 5 Africans matched him easily, and less than 15 minutes later they cleared the cave. Millen tore his helmet off.
"Let's hurry," he said.
The drive back to the camp was a red line, grueling affair. In the back seat, Millen held the handle on the roof and gritted his teeth. When the SUV's headlights caught sight of the white tents, the vehicle screeched to a halt, sending a plume of dust forward like a ghost wandering from the car toward the camp. When the cloud cleared, Millen's worst fears were confirmed. There was no movement anywhere. He had hoped the communication blackout was only an equipment failure. The 8 men exited the vehicles. Keto called into the Ministry of Health to apprise them of the situation. One of the Kenyan army officers updated their command post at the Mandera airport. The remaining 6 men, including Millen, approached the camp cautiously. The Kenyan soldiers held their semi-automatic rifles out, their fingers on the triggers. The camp was a horror show. Dead bodies were everywhere. Soldiers, WHO staff, CDC employees, and Kenyan Ministry of Health workers. Whoever had invaded the camp had left no survivors. There was no sign of Hannah. Yet, if by some miracle she was still alive, she wasn't crying out. The men spread out, searching the camp, but found only more death. Millen's fear mounted with every step. Still, he clung to the hope that she was alive, that Hannah had somehow escaped. He held his breath when he drew the flaps back on their tent. Empty. Quickly, Millen counted the SUVs. 1 was missing. There was still a chance she had gotten out. One of the soldiers yelled from beyond the camp. Millen was at his side a minute later, staring in horror. Dr. Jonas Becker's body lay in a crumpled heap at the bottom of an overturned SUV. He died fighting, Millen thought. But whom had he been fighting? Al-Shabaab?
"Dr. Thomas?"
the soldier called from the back of the SUV. The vehicle's rear door was open, and the ground behind it was covered in a massive pool of blood. Shattered glass was everywhere. Millen got out his sat phone and dialed a number in Atlanta. During the flight in, Dr. Shaw had been adamant that if the worst happened, the EIS member should bypass the EOC and call Elliot Shapiro directly. It was 5:30 p.m. in Atlanta, and the call connected on the first ring.
"Shapiro?"
"Dr. Shapiro, my name is Millen Thomas. I'm a first-year EIS agent deployed in Mandera."
"Sure,"
Elliot said. Millen could hear him walking in the background, a cacophony of voices and people typing on keyboards.
"What can I do for you, Millen?"
"Sir, we have a problem."
Chapter 36. The call had rattled Elliot. He had been doing his final rounds before leaving for the day, but now he sat at his desk, thinking through his next moves. What he did now could well determine whether his people in Kenya lived or died, including one young woman in particular who was very special to him. Elliot and his wife Rose had been blessed with two sons. One had died at the age of 3 in their pool. They had filled it in and planted a garden in its place as a memorial. The other son was an anesthesiologist in Austin, and they saw him a few times a year. Peyton was a regular at their home, however, and over the years both Elliot and Rose had begun to think of her, to treat her, as if she were the daughter they'd never had. He knew that the hours immediately after her abduction were the most crucial to ensuring her safe return, that acting quickly and decisively was the only way to protect her, to prevent any truly evil act from occurring. His first call was to the National Reconnaissance Office, where his request was met with immediate resistance.
"We need that sat telemetry right now, you understand?" he said. "I'm going to hang up now and call State and people way above your pay grade. I'm going to mention your name. If telemetry isn't available by the time I call you back, it will go badly for you."
He wasn't bluffing. He called the State Department next, and right after, his contact at the CIA. The moment he hung up, his office phone rang. It was the director of the CDC. Elliot had instructed Millen to call the EOC and update them immediately after their call. Apparently, word of the crisis had now reached the top of the food chain.
"Did you call State, Elliot?"
"Yeah." Elliot was typing at his computer, sending an email to Joe Ruto, the head of CDC in Kenya, urging him to contact the Kenyans about any assets they had in the area.
"Did you threaten them, Elliot?"
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Why?" Elliot shifted the phone to his other shoulder so he could type faster.
"Because they just called me. They're not happy."
"Uh-huh.
Is the White House going to approve the RDF?
Elliot believed a rapid deployment force scouring the area for Peyton and the other hostages was their best shot at getting them back. He had been working to make that exact scenario happen.
"They don't even have a target yet," the director said.
"Sure they do. The Al-Shabaab camps in Somalia."
"Be realistic, Elliot."
"I am. Realistically, who do you think did this? There's one terror network in the region, Al-Shabaab. They hate America. We've got extremely high-value targets in the area. It's them. They've got her."
"Her? Our people."
The director exhaled.
"Our people could be at any number of camps."
"I agree. We hit them all at the same time. It's the only way."
"Jesus, Elliot. You want to start a ground war in southern Somalia?"
"I want to raid known terrorist camps in search of American hostages. Since when did this become a tough sell?" A pause. Then the director said,
"Hang on a second."
Elliot heard mouse clicks.
"All right, there's a White House conference call in 15 minutes. I want to be on the call."
"No, Elliot. It's invite only. The president and national security advisor are going to be there. Please don't make any more calls. I know you're worried. I am too. I'll call you as soon as the conference ends, okay?"
"Yeah, okay."
Elliot slammed the phone down and sat, listening to his breathing for a long moment. A text popped up on his cell phone, which lay on his desk. From Rose. Message. Thinking of switching from Miller Union to Kaima. Okay with you? Elliot tapped the phone and dialed his wife.
"We're gonna have to cancel dinner."
Rose instantly read the tone of his voice.
"What's happened?"
"It's Peyton."
"Oh my God."
Elliot avoided giving his wife all the details. He merely told her that Peyton and her team were out of contact, and they were trying to determine if it was a technical problem or something else. White lies had become a routine part of his job, especially during his time in the field, but they had been less common since his promotion and years at CDC HQ. He far preferred being honest with Rose, but now wasn't the time for it. 10 minutes later, an email appeared in Elliot's inbox. The NRO had made the sat footage available. Elliot clicked the link and watched as black-suited soldiers attacked the camp at dusk. The footage ended with soldiers hauling two women out of the back of an overturned SUV. They placed black bags over their heads and dragged them to a clearing where a helicopter landed and took them away. Elliot grabbed his office phone and dialed the NRO analyst, defying the CDC director's order.
"Where'd the helicopter go?"
"We don't know. The area's huge. We don't have coverage over the whole thing."
"Does the helicopter show up again on another sat?"
"We don't know."
"What the hell do you mean you don't know?"
"It's an unmarked Sikorsky. We can't be sure it's the same helicopter."
"Do you have satellites over the Al-Shabaab terror camps?"
The analyst hesitated.
Do you?
That's classified, sir.
Classified? You're seriously not going to tell me if you can see a similar helicopter landing at a terrorist base?
I could lose my job, sir.
Lose your job? Let me tell you something. Right now, some terrorist thug is torturing and possibly sexually assaulting American citizens. Government employees serving our nation, just like you and me. Men and women who put themselves in harm's way to protect our families and our friends so we can go home tonight and sleep in safety. If you care about that at all, I want you to pull that footage from all those terror bases, and if you see that helicopter or anything else going on, please make a call. Let the National Security Advisor know, or whoever the hell you guys call. Will you do that?
Yes, sir, I will. Another text appeared on Elliot's phone. From Rose. Message. Any news? Elliot texted back. Not yet. Everything will be fine. Don't worry. At 6 p.m., Elliot's office phone rang. He snatched it up and listened, surprised at the voice on the other end, the head of watch at the EOC.
Elliot, we just got a flood of signals in. This respiratory disease is amplifying. Millions more cases.
Elliot said, interrupting.
Keep an eye on it. I'll call you back. But I think I'll call you back.
He hung up the phone and briefly considered calling the director to see if he had tried calling him. He stood and paced the room. His blood pressure had to be through the roof. He was glad Rose couldn't see him. He took a pill bottle from his top desk drawer and swallowed a blood pressure pill. After what felt like hours, Elliot's phone rang again.
All right, the CDC director said. They're putting two RDFs on standby and dispatching an aircraft carrier in the Gulf of Aden. The CIA special ops team at the Mogadishu airport are also on alert. As soon as they have reliable intel about the hostage's location, they'll move in.
That's it?
It's all we can do until we know where they are.
So what? We're going to wait for these kidnappers to webcast their demands? Or maybe force our people to read a statement? Or are we just going to wait and hope somebody gets drunk in a Mogadishu dive bar and mentions some American hostages?
What do you want, Elliot?
I want special ops raiding those camps in Somalia. We ought to be turning that place upside down.
What if they're not there? What if they're in Ethiopia or still in Kenya? Raiding the camps could get American soldiers killed, and it could provoke the kidnappers to kill our people in retribution.
First, those soldiers signed up for that, Elliot said. Special operatives know the risk. They know they're putting themselves in harm's way to save American lives. That's their job. And when our people deploy, they go out there with a simple assumption. If they get in trouble, the United States of America will come for them. We're not keeping our promise. How are we going to ask the next class of EIS agents to put themselves in harm's way if we aren't willing to protect this class, huh?
I'll keep you posted, Elliot. Go home. Try to relax.
The line went dead. Elliot threw the phone across the room. The gray Ethernet cord that connected it to the wall yanked it back like a yo-yo and slammed it into the desk. His door flew open, and Josh, his assistant, peered in. The younger man always stayed until Elliot left for the day. He looked down at the broken IP phone. I'll call IT. When the door closed, Elliot took out his cell phone and dialed an old friend.
I've got a story for you.
On the record?
Strictly off.
Related to the Kenya outbreak or this new thing?
Kenya. CDC employees have been abducted. The White House knows they're not doing a damn thing.
Chapter 37. When Elliot got home, he poured himself a drink and downed it quickly. Then he had another and sat in a large chair in the corner of his mahogany-paneled office, staring at nothing in particular. His eyes settled on a picture taken 7 years ago in Haiti. He and Peyton were facing the camera, his arm around her. It had been taken the day they found out there were no new cases in the cholera outbreak. That had been a happy day, one of the few during that grueling deployment. He picked up the remote and turned on the flat-screen TV.
CNN has learned that the abduction took place in eastern Kenya, near the border with Somalia.
Elliot watched the rest of the segment. It ended with,
"The White House has issued a statement saying they are following the situation and considering all options for the safe return of American and Kenyan personnel."
He walked to the kitchen, looking for Rose, but instead found a whole uncooked chicken in a glass dish on the center island, beside a few chopped vegetables. Rose had texted him to tell him she would cook, and he wondered if something had gone wrong. Rose had retired from teaching when their first son was born. She'd been a wonderful mother. After the death of their youngest son in the pool, she had dedicated much of her time to tending the garden they had created in its place, and to cooking the vegetables she grew there. The oven was on. Elliot squatted down and hit the light. It was preheated but empty.
Rose?
He called. No response. He walked to her office off the kitchen. The day's mail lay on her desk unopened. He found her in their bedroom, lying on top of the comforter, her clothes still on, the lights off. The curtains were open. The setting sun shone through the French doors that led to the patio.
Rose?
She didn't move. Elliot sat on the edge of the bed and gripped her hand, feeling her pulse with his finger. She was burning up, her heartbeat rapid. He held the back of his hand to her forehead, definitely running a fever. She opened her eyes, and upon seeing Elliot, instantly grew worried. She glanced at the clock on the bedside table.
Oh, no, I must have fallen asleep.
She pushed up on trembling arms, coughed, and fell back to the bed, reaching for the tissue box in the nightstand. Elliot heard the congestion in her chest as she coughed violently into a tissue. There were plenty more used tissues in the wastebasket beside the bed.
When did you start feeling sick?
He asked.
Shortly after you left this morning. It's nothing. I've got to get dinner ready.
Elliot felt her neck. Her lymph nodes were swollen. Her body was fighting an infection. She sneezed into the tissue, then sneezed again. Elliot brought the box closer, leaving it next to her in the bed. No, Rose, you're going to stay in bed and I'm going to fix dinner. She studied him skeptically. Okay, I'm going to pick up dinner. She smiled and squeezed his hand. He helped her out of her clothes and under the covers, then went into the bathroom to search the medicine cabinet. All the cold and flu tablets had long since expired. He found a bag of zinc lozenges and returned to the bedside with them.
Stay in bed, honey. Try these, they'll help. I'll go get dinner and some cold medicine. Be back soon.
Elliot ate a small snack to soak up some of the alcohol, then turned the oven off and moved the uncooked food to the refrigerator. Completing Rose's cooking was above his pay grade. A few hot trays from Whole Foods were his usual fare when she was out of town. That would have to do for tonight. The drugstore parking lot was filled to capacity. Elliot actually had to wait for a spot. The scene inside took him aback. People filled the aisles and argued at the checkout line. What's happening here? He went to the aisle that held the cold and flu medicine, but the shelves were utterly bare. Every last box and bottle of medicine was gone. There was a commotion at the back of the drugstore near the pharmacy desk.
My kid is sick! When will you get more?
A pharmacy tech strode past the drop-off window and met Elliot's eyes.
Excuse me,
Elliot said. Do you have any cold medicine left? The young woman shook her head as if she'd gotten that question a lot.
No, and we don't know when we'll get more.
If this was happening in Atlanta, it was likely happening across the country. Things were worse than the stats had revealed, much worse. Elliot needed to get back to work. They needed to get more aggressive and fast, and it was now urgent that they get the virus sequenced so they could compare it with the samples from Mandera. If the viruses were the same, he didn't want to even think about the possibility. The U.S. wasn't prepared for that. No country was. He considered calling Rose, but that might wake her. She needed her rest, and she probably wouldn't have eaten much anyway. There were still leftovers from last night in the fridge if she did get hungry. On the way to the CDC, Elliot dialed his son Ryan in Austin. Ryan and his wife and son were scheduled to fly to Atlanta that night to spend Thanksgiving at Elliot's home. He answered on the first ring.
Hey, Dad.
Hi. I was hoping to catch you before the flight.
Elliot could hear cars honking in the background.
Why, is everything all right?
Yeah,
Elliot lied.
Of course, just checking on you. There's a bug going around here.
Here too. Feels like half the city is sick,
Ryan said.
Adam? Samantha?
Elliot asked.
They're fine. We've all been lucky, dodged it so far. But Adam's daycare sent all the kids home yesterday.
He paused.
We're almost to the airport. You sure we should still come?
Elliot had been pondering that very question. If things went south, he would rather have his family close, and he didn't want to worry them.
Definitely. We're looking forward to it.
Okay, we'll see you later tonight.
Be safe, I love you.
Love you too, Dad.
At the front desk of the main CDC building on Clifton Road, Elliot swiped his access card.
A red beep. He tried it again. The security guard at the desk walked over.
I think something's wrong with my card, Elliot said.
It's not your card, Dr. Shapiro. Your access to the campus has been revoked.
What? By whose order?
In his peripheral vision, Elliot saw two more security guards walking to the turnstile.
I'm sorry, sir, I don't know.
Elliot took a few steps back from the entrance, allowing other staff to make their way past. They glanced back at him. He took out his cell phone and dialed the director.
Steven, I'm having a problem getting into the building.
Get used to it. You won't ever get back in the building if I have anything to do with it. Elliot considered playing dumb, but figured appealing to the director's sense of duty was the stronger play.
Look, whatever you think of what I did, it's done now. We've got a serious outbreak going on. We need all hands on deck, for the sake of the American people.
Save it, Elliot. We're well aware of the situation. Go home. And don't you dare say another word to the press.
Day 5. 50 million infected. 12,000 dead. Chapter 38. Desmond awoke with a new, more intense pain. The welt covering the left side of his chest was like a bee sting from a Volkswagen-sized bee. While he had been unconscious, they had moved him from the barn. His new cell was quite different. He was indoors in a very new and sophisticated facility. Metal walls painted white surrounded him on three sides, and a thick glass barrier looked out onto a wide corridor. He lay on a narrow bed with a simple mattress and no sheets. This was a proper prison, and a high-tech one at that. There was a speaker in the ceiling and a pass-through slot on the wall opposite the glass, presumably for food. The tranquilizer dart the soldier in the barn had shot him with had been powerful. Desmond sensed that he had been out for quite some time. And much had happened. They had taken his clothes, replaced them with green scrubs, and seen to all his wounds. He pulled up his shirt and inspected the cotton bandage on his side. It covered the shallow rut he had carved. His hands and feet were unbound. It felt good to be at least that free again. He wasn't sure exactly how he knew, but he sensed that he was on a ship. Perhaps it was the slight movement, or simply the proportions of the space and the fact that the walls, floor, and ceiling were all metal. He sat on the bed and waited. For how long, he didn't know. The hum of the fluorescent lights slowly became annoying, then deafening. Footsteps. Boots on the middle floor, marching with purpose. A man stopped in front of the glass divider and stared for a moment. Desmond recognized him instantly, the scar-faced man from his memories. His hair was longer now. The blonde locks hung across his face, partially obscuring the scars. The mottled, burned flesh stretched up from his chest, across his neck, chin, and cheeks, and stopped at his forehead. He wore a scruffy, sandy blonde beard that grew in uneven patches. It did little to hide the healed wounds, which must have once been excruciating. He looked almost inhuman. Desmond rose and moved slowly over to the glass wall.
Why?
His captor's question was laced with malice, and to Desmond's surprise, hurt. The man seemed enraged, but also vulnerable somehow.
Who are you?
Desmond asked.
The man sneered and spoke with a thick Australian accent.
Drop the charade, Desmond. I don't believe the whole amnesia bit.
Look, I have absolutely no idea who you are. I woke up in a hotel room in Berlin a few days ago with no memories. I didn't even know who I was.
We'll see about that.
The man brought a handheld radio to his face and said,
Proceed.
Inside the cell, a soft hissing began. Desmond looked around, searching for the source. The slot in the wall where he had assumed food was passed. He was unconscious within seconds. Awareness came in slow, fuzzy waves. Desmond's head felt heavy. He heard distorted voices, like people conversing quietly at the top of a well, with him deep inside. The light overhead was blinding. He was strapped to a chair similar to a dentist chair, his legs fully extended, his head strapped back. An IV was connected inside his elbow.
A machine beeped somewhere beyond his vision.
What have you done with the rendition?
It was the blonde, scar-faced man.
He's conscious, another man's voice said.
Dose him again. You're giving him too much. You gotta let it wear off. Do it.
When Desmond awoke once more, he was back on the narrow mattress in the metal and glass cell. His mind was sluggish, still drug-addled. Just beyond the glass, the blonde man sat on a folding metal chair next to a small table studying a tablet, his legs crossed. He set the device aside when Desmond stirred. His demeanor had changed. The hatred in his eyes was gone, replaced by a more serene, contemplative gaze. Desmond sat up.
You believe me now?
He asked. Yes. The man stood and walked to the glass.
Who are you?
My name is Connor McLean. Does that mean anything to you?
Desmond shook his head. Connor turned his back to the glass.
Right now, events are taking place that will forever alter the course of human history. Behind the scenes, behind the headlines, a war is raging. Very soon, it will explode around the world.
Headlines, Desmond thought.
The outbreak in Kenya.
Yes.
You're responsible. You started it.
No, Desmond. We started it.
The words hit Desmond like a Mack truck. He searched his feelings, wondering if it was true.
We're running out of time, Connor said. I need your help. I need you to tell me everything that happened to you. I need you to help me stop what's going to happen to all of us.
Let me out.
I can't.
You can.
Consider my position, Desmond. I don't know what happened to you.
What do you think happened to me?
I see two possibilities. The first is that one of our enemies got to you, and they're using you to try to stop us.
One of our enemies?
Yes. Until a few days ago, you and I were partners.
Partners in what?
The greatest scientific endeavor in history.
The looking glass.
Yes.
What is it?
I can't tell you that.
Why?
Because of the second possible reason you might have lost your memories.
Which is?
That you did this to yourself. That you betrayed us and our cause. That's actually the more frightening scenario. Either way, I'm not sure whose side you're on, Desmond. But if you recover your memories, you'll know the truth of what we're facing. You'll know that we're humanity's only hope. That the looking glass is our only hope.
There are three pieces, Desmond said.
Rook, rendition, and rapture. You remember?
No, the journalist told me.
Desmond's mind flashed to the man, the fear on his face when he'd said, "They have my fiancé."
What happened to him?
Connor averted his eyes.
I asked you a question. We sent him on an all-expenses-paid trip to Disneyland, Desmond. What do you think happened to him?
What do you want from me?
Rendition.
What is it?
Your life's work. Your piece of the looking glass.
Sitting on the narrow bed, Desmond tried to remember anything about rendition. Nothing came to him. The word evoked no memories, only a feeling. It must be protected. Instinctively, Desmond knew that if Connor gained possession of rendition, an unimaginable catastrophe would occur. A loss of life on a scale never seen before. He looked up.
What about the other components of the looking glass?
Rook is my project. It's almost complete.
And rapture?
Is safely secured by our partner. Listen, Diz, it's imperative that you remember what you've done with rendition. Lives are at stake, the very future of the human race.
The two men stared at one another, each trying to read the other. The hatch to the corridor opened, and a man and woman marched in. They set a laptop and a flat-screen monitor on the table where Connor had been sitting. They turned the screen to face Desmond's cell.
What's this?
We're going to try to help you remember.
The woman typed on the laptop, and a picture appeared on the screen. It showed a young, blonde-haired boy, perhaps 7 years old, standing next to a tall, ruddy-faced man in overalls. An oil rig towered behind them. Desmond studied both faces.
It's me, isn't it?
Yes. Do you remember him?
Desmond had seen the older man's face once before, in a memory. Out of pure instinct, Desmond lied.
No.
To the woman, Connor said,
"Keep at it. Call me if you make any breakthroughs."
Chapter 39.
When Connor had slipped out of view, Desmond again looked at the picture on the screen. Seeing it did bring back a memory, an unpleasant one. Soon after arriving in Oklahoma, Desmond learned why Charlotte had been so hesitant to put him on the airplane. Despite being his next of kin, Orville Hughes had no use for Desmond, or any 5-year-old boy for that matter. The man was tall and muscular, with a mean face, constantly arranged in a sneer. He lived just south of Oklahoma City, in a small farmhouse outside Slaughterville. Orville worked on the oil rigs, usually on 2 or 3 week shifts, after which he'd be home for a few weeks. Desmond was largely left to fend for himself. He looked forward to the time alone. When Orville was home, he drank whiskey late into the night and slept half the day. Sometimes he listened to music, mostly cowboy songs. The rest of the time he watched reruns of old westerns. Gunsmoke, Bonanza, and Have Gun Will Travel were his favorites. Desmond wasn't allowed to speak or make noise in any way when a movie with Charles Bronson, John Wayne, or Clint Eastwood was on. He was, however, required to cook and clean. His uncle meted out punishment only once for noncompliance. That was enough for Desmond. He soon identified a pattern to his uncle's drinking. The first half of the bottle barely affected the man. The remainder was like a potion that changed him completely. He got meaner with every swallow. He talked more, sometimes to himself, sometimes at Desmond, his English accent growing thicker by the minute. He talked about his childhood in London after the war. Everything was prefaced with "after the war." "You think your life is hard, boy? You don't know a thing about hard living. After the war, that was hard. You're soft, boy. Your daddy was soft, too. He took over that sheep ranch from your mother's family, lived a soft life, raised a soft little brat." He talked about work on the rigs, how hard it was, how heroic he was. Late at night, when he was deep into the bottle, he talked about the accidents. Men losing fingers, hands, entire limbs, deaths. The stories were gruesome. When Desmond couldn't take it anymore, he got up to leave. That was a mistake. His uncle yelled at him not to walk away when he was talking to him. "You're so soft you can't even bear to hear about real men's work, can you?" He took another swallow of whiskey. "Can you?" He studied Desmond. "You watched them die, didn't you? Then you ran away. That's why you got them scars on your legs, from running." He had argued then. That was his worst mistake of all. He learned after that. His uncle only wanted a verbal punching bag. It was like Orville was using his words to drain the poison out of himself. He didn't want that poison returned. Desmond learned to sit in silence. A few weeks after he arrived in Oklahoma City, Desmond learned why the bitter man had taken him in. Orville was standing in the kitchen, the phone cord stretching from the wall, muttering about how much the call to Australia was costing him. When the line connected, he demanded to know when the money would arrive. Desmond sat in the living room listening.
"I don't care if it's burned worse than the gates of hell. You sell that bloody property and send the money. That was the deal."
A pause.
"Well, send the money, or I'll send the snot-nosed brat back, and you can deal with him."
Desmond felt the tears welling in his eyes. He couldn't bear to let that monster see him cry, or to stay there another minute. He grabbed the rifle by the door and ran out of the house into the early March afternoon. He had decided. He was running away. He would live off the land, build another fort, live there until he could get a real job and get away. An hour later, he sat in a tree waiting. He missed the white-tailed doe with his first shot. The old rifle kicked like a mule, and Desmond nearly fell out of the tree. And the doe was gone before he could work the 30-30's lever and load another cartridge. But he held on and waited. Snow began falling, scattered flakes at first, and a steady downfall. Desmond had never seen snow before. In Australia, his father had said that it only snowed in the mountains of the Victorian High Country in the northeast. He watched as the white flakes blew in the wind. When the next doe emerged from the far tree line, he was more patient. It was smaller than the last, younger, less cautious. He waited as it meandered closer, sighted, held a breath as his father had taught him, and squeezed the trigger. The animal fell and flailed on the ground. Desmond was out of the tree in seconds, making tracks across the open field. He finished the poor doe quickly. As he studied his kill, he realized the foolishness of his plan. He had no way to clean the animal, store the meat, even cook the portions his empty stomach cried out for. But he could take it home, show his uncle that he could earn his keep, that he wouldn't be a burden. Seeing the doe would change his uncle's mind. Desmond was sure of it. He took it by the legs, began dragging it through the snow. He didn't get far. Desmond was nearly 4 feet tall and strong for his age, but the animal weighed nearly twice what he did. He would have to run back and get his uncle's help. He trudged through the snow, which was a few inches deep now. The cold wind whipped at his face and beat past the jacket Charlotte had sent with him. With each step, the white wall became more complete. He didn't know it then, but he was marching through a rapidly forming blizzard. The winds tossed him from side to side, disorienting him. It was like the fire in Australia. He was again caught in an inferno, only this one was made of ice. He got turned around so much that he had no idea which way home was. He knew the bush and paddocks around his parents' station like the back of his hand. This land was foreign to him. There were no markers to guide him. He was completely lost. He would die here, in the cold, alone. He was sure of it. He had survived the fire, had been brought back to life by an angel, only to die here, in the ice, left for dead by a devil. His legs ached. He desperately wanted to sit down, to rest. But somehow he knew if he did, he would never get back up. He pushed forward, clutching the rifle. He knew dropping it, losing it, would be a death sentence. He tried to fire it in the air to call for help, but he couldn't get his fingers to work. Through a break in the snow, he saw a column of smoke rising from his uncle's home in the distance. He made for it with every last bit of strength he had. When he reached the porch, he expected the door to fly open. It stayed closed. A yellow glow from the fire inside shone through the windows. Salvation. He threw the door open, leaned the rifle against the wall, and rushed inside. His uncle never looked at him, only shouted for him to close the door. Desmond eyed the bottle. It was nearly empty. He would have to be careful to stay out of the man's way. Chapter 40. Outside the brig, Connor marched down the corridor, his footsteps echoing loudly. The entire crew of the Kintaro Maru was bustling, preparing for the next phase. They would have to work very quickly to assemble the looking glass. Delay could cost billions of lives, perhaps even every human life. If he didn't find out what had happened to Desmond soon, their cause would be in trouble. Desmond held the key to the looking glass and to everything they'd worked for. Inside the infirmary's conference room, screens on the wall displayed x-rays, MRIs, and other scans Connor didn't even recognize. "What did you find?" he asked the three researchers conversing at the end of the table. A younger physician swiveled in his chair. "His body's a horror story. I've never seen so many fractures.
He had a rough childhood. Now tell me, what did you find?"
Dr. Henry Anderson, an older scientist with white hair, spoke up.
"An implant in his brain. It's located in the hippocampus."
"What kind of implant?"
"A Rapture Therapeutics model. It's been modified, though."
"Modified to do what?"
"That's not clear," Anderson said.
"But the added component looks like a data receiver and transmitter."
"What would it link up with? A satellite?"
"Possibly. But I count that as unlikely, not enough power. It's probably something shorter range. Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, maybe."
The younger scientist spoke again. "Could be used to communicate with a smartphone, which could act as a bridge to the net. It could be downloading instructions that would unblock memories."
"Interesting," Connor whispered.
Louder, he said,
"How'd it work?"
The older scientist shrugged.
"Who knows? This is all pure speculation. I was never a Rapture employee and didn't work on the project. Everything I know is from their published research. We know the original Rapture Therapeutics implants were used for depression, schizophrenia, bipolar, and other psych conditions. They monitored levels of key brain chemicals and stimulated the release of neurotransmitters. Basically, they helped balance the patient's neurochemistry. The later versions of the rapture implant, like the one inside Hughes, focused on other areas of the brain. Their published trials focused on dissolving brain plaques. The implants targeted the plaques and released a protein called GP3, which dissolved them. The approach has the potential to cure a wide array of neurodegenerative diseases. Alzheimer's, Huntington's, Parkinson's, and more.
Connor held his hand up.
How does that apply here? You found plaques in his brain?
No, we checked. We found something else, though. An unknown substance throughout his hippocampus.
What do you think it is?
I can only speculate.
Speculate away,
Connor said, losing patience.
Dr. Anderson inhaled deeply.
A few years ago, researchers at MIT discovered a way to actually isolate the location in the brain of specific memories. It was a breakthrough. The revelation that individual memories were stored biochemically in specific groups of neurons in the hippocampus. I believe the substance in Hughes's hippocampus binds the neurons associated with specific memories, making them inaccessible, in a manner similar to the way that brain plaques affect memories in Alzheimer's and physical abilities in Parkinson's.
And you think Rapture Therapeutics put that substance there? And that the implant in his hippocampus is a way to dissolve the substance, unblocking the memories, similar to the way GP3 dissolves brain plaques?
Yes, that's our hypothesis. We further hypothesize that the communication component that's been added to the implant is a triggering mechanism. A Bluetooth-enabled phone or Wi-Fi-connected computer could tell the implant to unlock the memories. Those triggering events could happen based on a set schedule, or when certain events occur, or perhaps even when Hughes arrives at certain GPS locations. It's also possible that certain cues, emotions, images, or sensations could unlock memories. The implant could be keyed to determine which memories are safe to reveal.
Connor leaned his head back and stared at the ceiling.
Well, gentlemen, it seems there's a very simple way to confirm your plethora of suppositions. Call Rapture Therapeutics. Ask them. After all, we own the company.
We just got through speaking with them, Dr. Anderson said. Their chief science officer confirmed that they do have a team researching memory manipulation, and that project is still active. Or was, until very recently.
Connor sensed bad news coming.
The project is called Rapture Aurora. They conducted their research following Looking Glass protocols. Compartmentalization, need-to-know access. The team working on the memory therapy was a completely independent cell, with its own budget and facilities. For the sake of the larger Looking Glass project, contact was limited. Rapture hasn't heard from the cell in 3 weeks.
They must have had a case manager, Connor said.
Realization dawned on him the moment he said the words.
Wait, let me guess. The Aurora project was based in Germany, and the case manager was Gunther Thorne.
Correct.
Connor shook his head.
What about Thorne's records? Protocol is for a secure backup in case he was compromised.
Rapture's been looking since he turned up dead in Desmond Hughes's hotel room. They haven't found it. They're assuming Hughes hid the files or destroyed them.
Connor paced for a moment, then turned to the scientists.
Okay, let's back up, review what we know, and try to put together a working theory here. Fact. 2 weeks ago, Desmond Hughes hides rendition. Every scientist working on the project goes missing. All the files are gone. Hughes turns up in Berlin, where he contacts a journalist at Der Spiegel, Gerin Meyer. Hughes is going to expose us and the entire Looking Glass project.
Dr. Anderson spoke up.
Rapture Aurora and his memory loss must have been his backup plan.
Right. Dez would have known about Aurora. Icarus Capital was an investor in Rapture Therapeutics. In fact, we used Icarus to fund most of the Looking Glass projects operating out of Rapture.
So, Anderson said, Hughes contacts the Aurora project team, gets them to administer their memory alteration technology on him, then either kills or hides the team. He somehow figures out where Gunther Thorne is keeping the project files and destroys or hides those as well, wiping out any chance of us figuring out exactly how Aurora works.
Very clever, Diz,
Connor mumbled.
But somehow, Anderson continued, Gunther Thorne figured out what Hughes was up to. Maybe he noticed the files were gone. Or perhaps he has some intrusion detection system Hughes was unaware of. He tracks Hughes back to the Concord Hotel, confronts him, A struggle ensues. Desmond comes out on top. He assumes Thorne had already alerted us. He activates Aurora, wiping his memories.
Connor shook his head. What a miss.
In a sense, it's brilliant, Anderson said. We can't torture the answers out of him. The memories are blocked no matter how much pain he endures. And without the Rapture Aurora research, we can't possibly unblock them.
Connor nodded.
He's brilliant. No question about it.
Connor sat down and tapped his fingers on the table, thinking. Is Aurora a core piece of the Rapture component? Could the loss of the Aurora research derail the Looking Glass?
No, Rapture is still intact. The memory piece was completed years ago. This additional Aurora research, using implants, seems to be a continuation beyond what was needed for Rapture.
Okay. Options?
We see only one predictable path,
the white-haired scientist said. A brain biopsy. Connor disliked the idea instantly. However, he simply asked, how?
I wouldn't recommend we do it on board the Kentaro Maru. Our facilities are advanced, but given the risks, I would strongly advocate conducting it in a hospital that specializes in neurosurgery. Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins would be my top choices. New York Presbyterian, Mass General, and Cleveland Clinic would also be appropriate. The problem is, very soon the pandemic will consume every hospital in the world, as well as the physicians we'd need for a biopsy.
Assuming we could solve those problems, what would a biopsy tell us?
We could get a better look at the implant and sample the substance in his hippocampus. We try to identify the substance, run tests on it to see if we can dissolve it without harming the underlying neurons.
I'm guessing that's not a 3-day turnaround.
No, it's not.
How long?
It's impossible.
Guess.
2 months? Who knows? I should also add that any brain biopsy carries risk to the patient. In this particular case, there could be risks we don't appreciate. Such as? A failsafe. If the implant and memory blockage are part of a purposeful plan on Hughes's part, or perhaps someone manipulating him, they might have programmed a failsafe. A foreign object entering his brain in the region of the implant might trigger some defense mechanism. Maybe it destroys the memories completely or even kills the subject. There's no way to know.
It's all moot. We don't have 2 months. Connor rubbed his temple. He felt a headache coming on.
We have Rook and Rapture, but he has rendition. Without it, we can't complete the Looking Glass. 2,000 years of work will go down the drain, and the entire human race with it.
The older scientist leaned back in his chair.
We could cut him loose and allow this to play out.
Play out?
Anderson nodded. Hughes clearly has some sort of backup plan. It's tied to specific events or locations, or some signal that will activate his memories via the implant. So what if we let him recover those memories? Then we collect him.
That's a lot of assumptions, Doctor. The biggest being that we can simply collect him when we're ready. Bagging him in the first place wasn't a walk in the park. When he recovers his memories, when he realizes what he's capable of, it'll be nearly impossible.
Then I'm afraid that leaves us with no options.
On the contrary, we have a very good option, gentlemen, and I'm going to take it.
Chapter 41. The soldiers were rough when they jerked Peyton and Hannah out of the back of the SUV. Hannah's screams didn't slow them one bit. They placed black bags over their heads, bound their hands, and marched them to a helicopter where their feet were bound as well. In the darkness, the drone of the engines and rotors was deafening. The helicopter landed some time later, and they were dragged out, lifted up, and tossed onto the flat metal bed of a truck. The drive was brutal. The truck bounced along ruts in the road, slamming them into the bed. And with their hands and feet bound, there was nothing they could do to protect themselves. It was like being blindfolded and left to tumble in a drying machine on an endless cycle. Hannah sobbed periodically. Peyton lost all sense of time. The pain ebbed after a while. Perhaps the nerves in her body simply stopped responding to the pounding. She wondered if any permanent damage was being done. At last the truck came to a stop, and she heard canvas flapping. A ray of sunlight beamed across the black bag, only partially seeping through. Someone gripped Peyton's feet, pulled her out of the truck, and caught her as she hit the ground. Her legs were weak, wobbly. Hands moved across her body, grabbing in places they had no right to. Peyton twisted,
turned her shoulders quickly, trying in vain to fight them off. The action sparked loud voices, speaking in what she thought was Swahili. Laughs erupted. She heard Hannah scream as they dragged her out.
"Don't touch her!" Peyton yelled. "She needs medical attention! A doctor!"
A man responded in African-accented English.
"She won't be needing nothing soon. Take them."
Hands reached under Peyton's arms, lifted at her armpits, and pulled her forward. Her bound feet dragged across the dry, rocky ground. To her surprise, her captors removed the bag before tossing her down. The light was blinding. She heard metal slamming into metal and the turn of a key. When her eyes adjusted, Peyton took stock of her surroundings. Her abductors had put her in a stall in a barn. Metal rods reinforced the slat wood walls. She turned and froze. Two sentences were carved into the nearby planks. "Desmond Hughes was here. I'm innocent." Peyton stared in shock. Desmond was here? Why? She heard clothes ripping and Hannah's labored breaths. The young physician was close, perhaps in the next cell.
"Hannah," Peyton called.
"Yeah?"
Her voice was weak.
"How are you doing?"
Hannah spoke slowly, quietly.
"Got the bleeding stopped."
She paused to catch her breath.
"Tied my shoulder up. Bullet went through, I think."
She drew another breath.
"Lost a lot of blood. Cold."
"Hang in there, Hannah. We're gonna get you out of here, okay? Some very brave Americans are gonna come for us. Save your strength and be ready for anything, you understand?"
"Yes, ma'am."
At that moment, something changed within Peyton Shaw. She had always lived a purpose-driven life, but it had been a life lived with a cold, clinical sort of passion. She never let her emotions master her. She was never out of control. She'd gotten that from her mother, she thought. Lynn Shaw was always composed, and Peyton loved her for it. That same composure had served Peyton well during her professional life. At work, keeping her emotions in check was imperative. Emotions clouded judgment, changed how a person looked at things. Becoming emotionally attached during an outbreak was a risk. She might be too focused on a particular patient or location, might miss the big picture or a detail, a crucial contact or piece of information that could save lives. Her emotional detachment had saved lives, and it saved her a lot of grief over the years. Now, however, in this makeshift cell, as she lay on the dirt floor, the wall of detachment Peyton Shaw had carefully built up over so many years fell. Her emotions broke through in a wave. They took